There's a part of me that wants to say, hello, longtime friends. I think this is the 93rd time I preach with David Hughes. I just love it when he goes on vacation because I get to see you all again. I commend you for being willing to change. It's just the era we live in, and we in the church cannot avoid that. And the way you've adapted while your sanctuary is being renovated. I changed my will recently, and it now has a clause that says, once First Baptist Church has moved into its new sanctuary, or renovated sanctuary, one of my last wishes is to be able to preach in that sanctuary. You are so good. And I love it when I see you out in the community or restaurants and other places and you come over and we talk. Don't stop doing that. I thoroughly enjoy it. Would you bow with me now? Jehovah God, Good Shepherd, You who got us to the paths that we always need to go, guide us now into that space of wisdom of God. And may we hear His words in the name of You, O Lord. Amen. The conversation occurred one November day in the African country of Senegal. An American who had gone there to help the destitute people mentioned to them that he was preparing to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. When he said that, they were bewildered and confused. They did not honor that day, so they pressed him to explain the purpose and meaning of it. He willingly elaborated, going all the way back to the story of the pilgrims and the evolution to Thanksgiving Day, and he summarized it by saying, Thanksgiving is a day we set aside to give thanks and celebrate for all the good things God has done for us. When he had finished, one of the men said, we do not have a day like that here. If we did, we would not call it Thanksgiving Day. We would call it God Has Forgotten Us Day. God Has Forgotten Us Day. Those are compelling words. Very, very compelling. And yet, we do not have to travel to Africa to know someone who has experienced the tragedies and sadnesses and sufferings of life. And we've known they have gone through those periods of feeling abandoned by God. And we know that at some certain junctures, one of those persons is a person we have seen in the mirror. God has forgotten me. The Old Testament character of Joseph reveals to us a person who walked such depths. No doubt, there were times that he said, God, where are you? Why have you forgotten me? Why do I say that? Well, just look at his story. Joseph's father was Jacob, and Jacob made a monumental parenting mistake. He had 12 sons, but he favored one over all the rest, and that one was Joseph. And the other 11 brothers took that disfavor that they felt from their father and focused it with hatred on Joseph. And when they could take this favoritism no longer, they sold Joseph to a group of traveling traders, and they took Joseph to Egypt. How cruel. How excruciatingly cruel that must be, to know your own family did that to you. When he went to Egypt, he was bought by a rather wealthy man whose name was Potiphar. Potiphar quickly began to see how keen Joseph's intellect was and how many gifts that he had. So he promoted him to the highest level of his servant. He would be the administrator of all Potiphar's own, and he would be foreman over all of Potiphar's servants and hired workers. However, Potiphar's wife began to make seductive advances toward Joseph. But each time he refused and walked away. Finally, one day, she reached out and grabbed his garment and tried to pull him into her bedroom. But Joseph tussled and finally worked his way out of the garment and ran away. Angered by this kind of rejection, Potiphar's wife screamed out to those who were in the home, "Joseph has assaulted me. Come and see. Here's his coat. I have evidence of it." And when Potiphar learned of that, he was incensed. And he had Joseph dragged off to prison. While he was in prison, Joseph encountered one of the Pharaoh's chief aides. His title was cupbearer. He had been placed in prison by Pharaoh because he had angered him. And because he was a chief top aide of Pharaoh, he was assigned a servant when he was in prison. That's hard to compute, isn't it? And that servant was Joseph. One day, Joseph provided this chief aide some wisdom to help him see that in just 3 days, he would be released from prison and he would return to his high level of cupbearer beside Pharaoh. And then Joseph said to this aide, "Please remember me to Pharaoh. Tell him how inhumanely I was brought from my home country and how I have been suffering under this injustice of being in prison. Help him release me." But as Laurie read, when he was released and restored to his top aide position, this man did not remember Joseph. And he spoke nothing of Joseph to Pharaoh. Can you imagine the number of times that enmeshed in all of that injustice and suffering, Joseph had to have felt, God, where are you? Why have you forgotten me? The writer of the Old Testament book of Lamentations expressed it this way. He said, my soul is bereft of peace. I can find no happiness. And so I say, gone are any expectations I have of God. On January 23rd, 1841, years before he was elected president, in a letter to his law partner and personal friend following a series of devastations, Abraham Lincoln wrote these words, I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were to be equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. Whether I shall get better, I cannot tell. I expect I will not. The words of what almost all historians say, coming from the greatest president this country has ever known, and the president who brought us through our most critical period. But at one point in his life, he said, God, you have forgotten me. A significant part, if not the major contributor of one piece of this dynamic, is a misguided belief. A belief that is so strong, it is as if it was placed in a cement block and then put in a vault and then embedded deep within our souls. That belief is life is supposed to be fair. Life is supposed to be fair. Where we get that belief is baffling. I've never talked to anyone who said, my father, my mother, my pastor, my Sunday school teacher, my professor, my mentor, a wise man, I've never heard any of them say that any of those people said to them, now don't ever forget, life is supposed to be fair. It's not written in any books, at least not in any that I have read. Whatever, what is written in countless books and seen all around us, is this, life is not fair. Life isn't fair. And that's a reality. And therefore, we must reach down and pull that vault up and open the door and take that cement block and throw it away forever. Life isn't fair. the acclaimed psychiatrist, Dr. Karen Horney, said many times and also wrote, the difference between a psychotic and a neurotic is that a psychotic says 2 + 2 = 5. They're totally out of touch with reality. A neurotic says 2 + 2 = 4. But I don't like it. I'm not going to believe it. And I want to adjust my life to fit it. As long as we have, even in our unconscious, just a modicum of a belief that life is supposed to be fair, there will be periods of turmoil in our lives. Suffering and pain, anxiety, depression, sadness. And when one of the cruelties of life slams us, internally we will say, God, you have done it to me again. You've forgotten me. At this point in my presentation, I had three options of what to say. And over extended period of time, I tried to see which one was the right one. The one I will tell you was my third option. In fact, for a few days, I just completely got it off the table because it is so personal and so transparent. And then God showed me that that had to be the first choice. And He showed me why. My mother and my older brother, who was handicapped, and I grew up in a small, predominantly mill town. Life was about survival. So I began a series of jobs, starting at age 10 with shining shoes in a barbershop. 15 cents a shine plus tips. Now, don't feel sorry for me about all of that. There were times tips were really good. I remember one day a gentleman walked into the barbershop that none of us had ever seen. And so we labeled him like we labeled all people who came in that we'd never seen. There's a stranger in town. I asked him if he wanted his shoes signed, and he said yes. And while I was shining his shoes, he began to ask questions about me. How old are you? What grade are you in? What kind of grades do you make? Do you go to church? Do you have a savings account? Yes, sir. Is it in the bank? No, sir. It's in the local savings and loan. When I finished, he stood up and he said, here's 15 cents for the shoe shine. And then he pulled out a dollar bill and he said, and this is for your savings account at the savings and loan. Now, folks, do the math. In today's dollars, you tell me any 10-year-old who wouldn't work for 15 minutes to make $28. But at age 16, I realized I had to get out of that small town because it was suffocating me. Because of its lack of motivation and collective boredom, which resulted from the community's intentional design that every day was to be the same. Yesterday was good, and so today is supposed to be like yesterday. And tomorrow is supposed to be like today. And the next day is supposed to be like tomorrow. That was okay for them, but it wasn't okay for me. So I began a journey of ambition, praying, asking God to guide me, and taking risks, sometimes extreme risk. But I finally got to where I wanted to be, and I was really happy. And I was very thankful. And then I began to get a gnawing feeling that God wanted me to go into the ministry. So I began, as we ministers say, to try to bargain with God to back him off. I did more in the church, got more involved. I even taught training union to junior high girls at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Now, for a 24-year-old single guy, that is really sacrifice. But each time, God said, that's not enough. And when that gnawing feeling reached its peak, I said, not that, God, please. Not ministry. You never told me that was in your long-range strategic plan for me. But eventually I realized that I'd never be happy if I didn't go into the ministry. So I started once again risking, which, as you know, are really steps of faith, believing that this is what God wanted me to do and He would guide me through it. It meant going back to school and getting a 3-year to graduate degree. And then a year and a half of postgraduate work. A 75% loss of income. But as those years began to go by, I realized I never had any idea this good. And now I consider myself one of the most fortunate people in all the world. And through that process, I have learned that seeking God and taking risk really is the only way to live. Now, here's the why behind that very personal story. The same is true for you, isn't it? Isn't that true for you? Can't you look back on your life when you were willing to relinquish control of your life to God and follow the Spirit's leading? Don't you see that each time you were willing to do that, God provided you exactly what you needed and exactly the right time? Isn't that true? Sure it is. All of you could come stand behind this lectern and say, let me tell you about what God did for me here. And then He did this. And then God did this. You all can do that. And that's the why behind the personal story. For you to personally look back on your journey. And yet, there are those times when God is silent. Sometimes excruciatingly so. And we go through anywhere on a continuum of uncertainty, into anxiety or into a period of darkness? What are we to do at those times? You do exactly what you did a moment ago. You look back on your life and you remind yourself of when God did this and God did that, and you realize how much God has worked in your life all along. And then you know that if God has been with me this far, He isn't going to stop now. And you resolve that I will trust God to show me the light to eventually get me through this period of darkness. You look back and follow that process. I call that living on yesterday's faith. Living on yesterday's faith to get me through today. Somebody asked a question. That question is, can you count on God? Can you count on God?